Thank you very much, Dima. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here today. You can also see me and Paco online, where we have, like, a smaller version of what I'm going to tell you today. So the main question for today is whether we can say something sensible about how zebrafish interact in collectives, how we compare our type of models in zebrafish with classical models that have been developed for group behavior. I will also spend a bit of time trying to tell you, because that might be useful for other people, how do we obtain high-quality data in collectives. The way I'm going to do it today is hopefully something similar to this. First, I will spend a few minutes with some brief historical background that will set the reference for the type of models I will explain afterwards. I will spend some time explaining some very simple models and simple experiments that are designed to gain insight on group behavior in zebrafish. I will then say, okay, they are limited. There is a limit to what they can explain, but I will use them to give an intuition of what to expect to happen when animals move in a group. And then I will say, okay, then let's try to move into groups of zebrafish. We will have the problem of how to track them. I will spend a few minutes explaining how we do it. And then I will use that data to build more data-driven models of collective behavior in zebrafish, whereas these models are going to be more hypothesis-driven and simple and very controlled. These ones are going to be more data-driven to see what the animals offer us as an explanation. Let's start with the historical background. I'm going to go back to 1785, in which Condorcet used the fact that probability theory was being developed at those times to try to model how a jury might be better than one person at knowing whether someone is guilty or innocent. The model is very simple. Imagine that you have one person answering questions about geography, let's say, and he or she needs to choose between two options for a given question. One will be incorrect, and the other one correct. It's a binary choice case. And Condorcet assumed that this person will have a probability P of being correct in the geography questions, let's say. An interesting thing comes when he considered now more than one person, let's say three, all the three with a probability of P of being correct. And then you ask, what is the probability that the majority, in this case two out of three, will be correct? So let's see. Okay, let's say that we have one person, and you ask to that person many geography questions. And by design, I will say that this person will have a probability 0.6 of being right. First question, right. Second question, wrong. Wrong, right, wrong. Okay, and you ask 20 times, and around 12 will be correct. Now, what happens when you have three, and each of them has a probability P of being correct? So you go through the second person, there is the same probability P, the same probability P, but when you count what the majority says here, okay, right, wrong, that would be right. The majority is right. Wrong, majority is wrong. Wrong, right, majority is right. And then you count, and it gives a value that is slightly larger. So when you have here, we plot the probability that a majority is correct against the group size. At the beginning, with one person, we have 0.6, and now we have a bit more with three people. If you do it with nine, let's say, and you do the same exercise, you count when the majority is right, it will turn out that the value is a bit larger. And if you keep increasing the group size, it keeps increasing, and at some point in the limit of group size tending to infinity, we tend to one. if the initial value is not 0.6 but 0.8, it will be closer to 1 much quicker. If it's closer to 0.5, it will be very slowly be growing. And if it's below 0.5, the majority will go to a probability 0 being correct. Okay? That's the model of Condorcet. Now, we can spend a lot of time talking about it, but let me move on. But this is a model. Now, what Galton did was an experiment. This is in 1907. He was worried about democracy and whether it would work. He started his Nature paper saying, in these democratic days, any investigation into the trustworthiness or peculiarities of popular judgments, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So he did a very simple experiment in which he asked 784 people what was the weight of an ox. Each of them independently wrote down what they thought the weight of the ox was, and he ordered them in increasing values. And he found that the median value of these 800 people gave this 1,198 pounds value, and the real one was just 1% off that prediction. And actually, the prediction in this particular experiment that Galton did was better than all of the people. No one, not even a single person, was better than the mean or the median. Okay? What's that? What's that?
The guy in the middle.
Oh, okay. In the real experiment, no one was as good as the... I guess I put the guy in the middle with the number, and then I put the values to the two sides.
If you take the median, there will always be one.
The mean is not better. However, I mean, again, like in the case of Condorcet, we can criticize this type of experiments. Let's do it very quickly by saying that if you ask other type of questions, you don't get the same kind of answers. So, for example, if you ask what is the border length between Italy and Switzerland, although it's a weird question, if you go to Wikipedia, it will tell you that it's 734 kilometers, and the median value of 100 people in a given experiment gave a 60% error. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
To what degree is that biased by the fact that this thing is sort of fractal, so almost any number will do?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I say it's a weird question. But you can find, for example, there were questions in, if you ask people how many murders were there were in Santa Barbara last year, typically there will be like 60%, 100% off. So maybe I chose not the very best.
That's consistent with your previous slide. If the p is about 0.5, then that gives you about 60%.
Yes.
Nobody knows the answer, so it's a random toss. And the one before is probably 0.8, and then a conversion.
Yeah, exactly. So it's consistent with not doing it correctly. Yes, exactly. So, but both Condorcet and Galton used the results to argue that groups are very good. But you can see that they don't need...
If P is greater than 0.5.
Yeah, exactly. That was the result. The Condorcet result is that if P is greater than 0.5 in the limit of larger groups, it goes to probability 1. However, it's even worse than that. Because the assumption there, we didn't go into the details, is that everyone is independent, statistically independent. Okay, not that they write down the answer without talking to each other. People are not independent, so it's not even valid in general. Anyway, so the idea behind these type of models is that you would do the mean or the median, an operation that eliminates noise. It has been very influential also in the study of animals. For example, this model of Ian Cousin and collaborators, it's a bit more complicated. We'll go back to this type of models, but a focal animal is here, and if, for example, you will orient to the animals around it by doing the average of the velocity vector. So it does an average and then it goes with the average. It looks at orientations of all the animals around it, and it chooses the average. And it has been in most of the models of collective behavior, it's assumed that the world of Condorcet and Galton sort of works, and doing the mean and the median will give you the right answer of doing things. So the logic of this type of work would be like you have a group giving estimations. Let's say that they are choosing between two options. Let's say one is -1 and the other is 1. And you have a list of estimations from the group. And there are some operations you need to do on the list. For example, you calculate the majority or you calculate the median. And these are operations that try to eliminate the noise in the individuals. I mean, the list of problems is very large. It's obviously catastrophically incorrect if knowledge is in a minority, because it's looking at the majority. So if the minority is the one that knows, these operations will erase the knowledge in the group. So the majority can be biased, and it's typically biased in most questions. So using the majority or the median or the mean will be very biased for many questions. And as I was mentioning before, the models assume that there are no correlations among the individuals, and that's not realistic. But anyway, they set the stage to many of the models in collective behavior by saying, OK, we have noisy individuals, and we need some operations to eliminate that noise.
Is the knowledge always in the minority first?
What's that?
Isn't the knowledge always in the minority initially? In the sense that if there's a predator coming or something, a few are going to know before the information.
I agree with you, and we will try to see how we get into that. Yes. Yeah. So the sense, the intuition for many of us is that something new will come not from everyone knowing at the same time, but from a small minority. So ideally, models of collective behavior should allow for minorities to show their knowledge. Okay. But it's not in any of the traditional models, in most of the traditional models, and not even in the collective behavior models in animals. Okay, we're going to look now at some very simple models and simple experiments. And the idea here is to gain some insight of what could be going on. The model is going to be hypothesis driven, so it can be wrong by design. And the idea is going to be the following. Imagine you have George looking at one part of the space, and he sees this thing here. So George could be deciding on what he sees, but George has some friends. And the modeling assumption here is going to be that what George is going to do is something similar to computing the probability that there is a predator in the world, given what he sees, and given the behaviors of agents that are similar to himself. That's going to be the modeling assumption, OK? You can find all the steps in the derivations of the mathematics I'm going to give you. I will go directly to the results so we can discuss what it means.
Sorry.
Yes?
Could you repeat this? I didn't get it.
So the modeling assumption is that George is going to compute the probability that there is something out in the world, let's say a predator, given what he sees about the world directly. So an image of something that could be a predator with some widths before, but also given what other agents are already doing. So these agents are escaping from this point of space, and that might increase the probability that that might be a predator. Okay. Now, let's stick to the simplest case. Let's say that George is with some friends, and there are two options, X and Y. I can promise to you that with some of the simplest assumptions, the modeling assumption I gave to you for this particular case boils down to this expression. This expression says that if George is trying to estimate to which option to go, the probability of going to Y should be given by this formula here that I'm going to explain in the following. If we plot this expression, so this is the probability of going to Y, against the number of animals that are already at Y and the number of animals at X, the difference between the two is simply a function that grows. So the more animals that are at Y, the more George should go to Y, okay? Because these animals are telling George that, that might be a good option to go. So what are the elements in this expression here? You have an X, the number of animals at X, 3 in this plot. And Y, the number of animals at Y, let's say 1 in this particular case. And then we have two parameters, A and S. If you work out the theory, A, we will use it as a parameter for the experiments, but if you do the theory, it boils down to this thing here, which is the probability that, given the private information that George has from the world, that X is a good option to go to, divided by the probability that if George is seeing privately something in the world C, Y is the best option. So this is the private information that George has about which option to go to. So if I change the value of A and I make it smaller, so that means that George knows privately that Y might be a good option, the curve shifts to the left. So it's more likely that he goes to Y for any value of the difference of NY and NX. Then there is another parameter, S, which if you, again, look at the theory, is going to tell you that this parameter means that this is the reliability of the friends. So how the friends are telling George that any of the options are good. So your friends are very unreliable, then this would be very flat. But if your friends are very good at knowing which option is good, then S is higher, and this is more steep. So you can rely on your friends very quickly, and only with a difference of a few animals between Y and X, you know that Y is a good option, because your friends are very reliable, and if they are in Y, they are telling you that Y is a good option.
Shouldn't it be like ratio of ends? Because like if ends are very big, then the difference of one maybe not as meaningful.
What's that? It should be a ratio?
I was thinking like if n is very large, both ends are very large and differ by one.
You mean that the, instead of the difference should be the ratio?
I would say so.
Okay. So there is a, okay, it's true that the different derivation is the simplest one you can do from the idea. There are others that can look more like a ratio. Yeah.
So maybe related to that, A and S not necessarily are independent of each other, right? So if an animal has less confidence of his previous experience in that particular environment, it might give more weight to what the friends are actually doing, no?
Yes. Exactly. Actually, if you look at the formula, this depends also on private information, which I'm ignoring a bit.
Okay, so I missed. C is what?
C is the private information.
Ah, I see.
So this number actually depends also on the private information. Yeah. So yes, there are couples. Yes.
The parameter A and the private information, are those like priors, or they're just some priors?
Yeah, you can think of it as the prior, yes.
And those are, in the modeling, they're assumed, you just kind of assumed up front whatever the shape of these priors are?
What's that?
In your model, are these assumed to have a particular functional form?
No, in the experiments, I'm going to assume that they are numbers. So imagine that you have a darker side, and the fish like the darker side. I make A to be a particular number, so there's a bias, private bias, to go to that side. Hi,
for a while, I mean, for a couple of years, I was reading this paper, so I'm trying to understand why is the choice of an exponential Fermi function, right? So what I mean is I would expect animals to make correlated mistakes, right, at some point. And if the mistakes are correlated, then I would expect a probability of a large deviation in the wrong direction. I mean, as an observer, I would, like as another fish, I would expect large deviations in the wrong directions to be
important.
Not unlikely, right?
Yeah.
So why exponential? Why not something that has a longer tail near zero?
Yeah. So I mentioned that this is the simplest form. Actually, the assumption in this simplest form is that when George is deciding, he is considering the rest as independent. Okay. So there are dependencies on using this formula several times, but I'm assuming independence to be able to write something simple down. So this exponential form only comes assuming independency. Okay. Now, in the paper, there is a more complicated way of explaining correlations, but I wanted to use this formula to explain, to give some insights in an analytical way, but I'm assuming no correlations. You're right, Ilya. Okay, so let's apply it in the simplest way possible. Let's say that we have two animals choosing between X and Y. You apply the formula. Let's say that A equals 1. We have a setup in which the two choices are privately the same. So let's say that George decides first. You apply it. Goes to, let's say, X. But then the other fish needs to decide and now applies it with 1 or minus 1. And in the end, what you find is a configuration that could be the two fish at X. They might split or they go to Y. And you can see already that if you look at the probability of a final state and the proportion of fish going to Y, you have here the probability of two fish going to Y, and here two fish going to X, is less probability of a split. So the dynamics makes the animals stick together a bit, but they can split. And the reason why I explain this simple way of using the model is because I'm going to compare it to experiments. These are going to be data for sticklebacks from Ashley Ward and collaborators in which you have a number of real fish and some replica fish. We have replica fish going to Y, sorry, to X and to Y. And we are going to plot in for 20 experiments the proportion of fish going to X. So here, all the fish go to X, here half of the fish go to X, and here all the fish go to Y. If I apply the model, as I was telling you, for all this data, we're going to see the following results. But let's first look at the data. We have here the replicas going to X and Y. So one replica to X, one replica to Y. 2, 2, 0, 1, 1, 2, 0, 2, 1, 3, 0, 3. And you have the group size is the real stickleback size. So you have either 2 fish, 4, or 8. And these are the results you obtain. Now, because it's a symmetric setup, A must be equal to 1, and I have one parameter, S, that can I allow myself to fit for all the data. I cannot allow myself to have one value of S for this graph, another one for this graph. I need to use the same one for all of them. So one parameter for all the data, and around 2.5, that's a reasonable job. So you can see that these type of models do seem to work. At least you cannot say that they don't work. Now, in an asymmetric setup with a value of A, then you can have a replica predator and you can have a real fish and a replica fish going to the side of the predator. So they are being fooled. They don't want to go there, but one of the replicas is going there. You can have 0, 0, so they go to the side where there is no predator. 0, 1, 0, 2, and 0, 3, and then you can fool them. And if you apply the model, again, I don't allow myself to move S now because that's the one I should be using, but with a value of around 10, it gives a reasonable fit for some of the graphs. There's one that doesn't really work. I believe it's an experiment, but...
Yes. Technical question of experiment. So these are single trials? Or
this is 20 experiments, and you look at the final configuration in each of the 20 experiments.
But with a single shot. It's not that they are repeated many times.
No.
Okay.
It's different fish.
Yeah.
You have one configuration, another configuration, and you plot the probability of finding a configuration. Okay.
Sorry, I'm missing something. They're all adults, and you take the same sex? Or
what's that?
They're all adult fish, and you take the same sex to do the experiment?
Or? These are sticklebacks, no zebrafish yet. They are adults, and they didn't look at sex differences.
Okay.
Okay, in this type of theories, unlike the case of Condorcet or Galton, you can have different fish with different weights. You can have a value of S, the reliability of one friend. Your friend might be really good, another one really bad, another one different. So you can have different fish with different reliabilities in the theory. And if you have, for example, an experiment with real sticklebacks, and then you modify the fish going to Y and X in size and pattern, you might be changing these values of S. So let's say that you have one replica here and one replica there. So it boils down to this expression here. And now you can change, for example, the size. You can have a large fish and a small fish, large, medium, medium, small. And again, now I need to fit this ratio here, again with my S2.5, and it seems to work. But more than the fitting, what I wanted to stress is that unlike the case of Condorcet or Galton, what these kind of theories are telling me is that I am free to think that the animals have different weights in the final decision, okay? And I'm going to use that idea later on. So, although I told you that that was one of the simplest derivations one can do, we've done different ones. Before, actually, I was assuming that when X was a good option, Y must be a worse option. We developed a different theory because actually when we did experiment with zebrafish, the previous theory didn't work. And then we extended to the case in which the mathematics allowed both options also to be good or bad. One can be better than the other, both can be bad, or both can be good. When you do that, actually, although the mathematics turns out to be different, the result is not very different. Remember, we had the difference between nx and ny. We just have a k there, okay, instead of a number one. So when you do experiment with zebrafish, here now you have George again, and he's choosing between x and y, and you plot this function here, the probability that George goes to, what did I write, x, against the number of animals in x and y. The function for a particular set of values a, s, and k has that shape, and the experiments are very close to the theory. So, a bit different to the theory before, just by needing that the two options could be both good or bad. And this theory actually is the one that seems to fit better other animal species. For the sticklebacks, it boils down to k equals 1 or greater than 1. For ants, intermediate values, and for zebrafish, k equals to 0.
So, what's the meaning of k?
So, k actually is how an animal choosing y tells you that x is a good option. So, before, everything was very symmetric. So an animal going to Y is telling you that actually that X is not a good option to go to. And now maybe the both options might be good. So maybe going to Y does not tell you that X is a bad option. If you give that freedom, for example, in the case of zebrafish, it's an extreme case, K equals to 0. So it doesn't matter that another animal chooses Y. X might be still a good option to go to. But before, because when one option was good, the other one had to be bad, they were very coupled. Now they can be different.
It's just a parameter, or we can have an independent value of its meaning?
So for comparison with experiments, I made it to be a parameter. It's a function in general.
So k equal to 0 goes back to the previous case?
No, k equals to 1 is the previous case.
Sorry.
K equals to 0 is a zebrafish case.
That depends on the task, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So one could think that because I took these different data sets of zebrafish, ants, and sticklebacks, it would be the species that is choosing the K value. I don't think so, as Mathieu is pointing out. I think it's more a task. So if I were brave enough to try more experiments of this type in different species, I bet that you will obtain that in a given experimental setup, ants can show a k equals to 0 case.
But did you try to test the sticklebacks and the zebrafish on the same task?
No, I did not.
That would be fun.
No. Experiment in zebrafish, for example? Yeah, it's a very simple experiment. Sorry. So, options X and Y are separated by transparent plastic. So all that George has is visual. And I'm counting that it's choosing X when it's very close to the partition X, okay? And then what I do is to change the number of animals at Y and X, and then I have a different point in the graph. And I do it 20 times for every configuration, and I change the fish all the time. So these are hundreds of fish.
That's collective response attraction to peers. That's like what this is.
Yeah, so this is attraction of George to other fish. Yeah. So depending on the size, you get a different value. Yeah.
So exactly, how many parameters are used to fit this data?
Three. S and K. Although in zebrafish, it turns out that K equals to zero, so you can lie a bit and say that it's two, but no, I mean, it's three. Okay. I build a theory, three appear, and it turns out that K equals to zero in the zebrafish case.
And so I have really bad sort of intuition about how easy or how difficult it is to achieve a similar quality of fit from some kind of an alternative model, a simple model where an animal does a biased random walk or something like this, or you know, something like the V-check, something attraction to other animals, whatever, right? So is there a comparison to...
Yeah, so actually we did manage to build simple models for zebrafish in which we moved, let's see, was basically moving almost randomly to one of the fish and sticking to that side for a while. Mm-hmm. And then you count, you allow the fish to move around and count how many times it's here and here, you obtain something similar to this surface. But it never managed to have a single type of model that will go through the different cases. So I can build a model for this case, I can build you another model for this case, I can build you another simple model for this case, but I never managed to have one of those V-check type models that could run through them by changing a parameter. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. That's me. Okay.
For these collective behavior experiments, I'm assuming it's mostly isolated to vision. Do you get a sense of how many studies are looking beyond vision or in addition to vision?
So I have to confess that most experiments either isolate vision or assume that vision is the main sensory input, but of course it's not. You have the lateral line in zebrafish. But I would assume that for large distances it's mainly vision in zebrafish, and maybe for short ones could be the lateral line.
Do you get a sense that people are enthusiastic about taking on, you know, the sensory modalities? Because people are olfactory.
They seem not to be that enthusiastic, but they should, yes.
Yes. But there must be a speed issue also here, right? Because vision in general is slower than the mechanosensory responses. So one might think of really fast responses, the mechanosensory feedback might be a problem.
Yes, but also it's very ambiguous having 20 animals around, so vision is more reliable, yes. Okay, but I actually wanted to explain these models, and not going into many details of whether you can obtain the ratio and other things, to explain that in a way they can be very insightful, but they are very limited. One of the issues is that it's a choice between two sizes in a very particular setup. There is no motion of the collective. So the experiments are fairly simple, and the explanations are, again, very simple discrete options, very reduced kinematics. So I still think as if these models were, to some extent, right, but they are very limited in what they can offer. But so the rest of my talk is about trying to tell you how you can move on into more complex models. They're going to be more data-driven, so maybe less satisfactory for someone like Ilya. But I wanted to see what the zebrafish could offer to me. The intuition already that you might get from this type of models for collective motion, even if it's very difficult to build a model that can do all these things in a reasonable way, that you have too much freedom in the theory. But the intuition would be, if what George is doing is using other animals to know what places in the world are good or bad, if these guys are here, then this region of the world would be a reasonable region to go, and we would say that George gets attracted to them. If these guys are moving together to some point in space, then according to this type of models, what this means is that there is something around here that is also a good place to go, and you would say that what George is doing is to align to these guys. But if you have an animal here, that doesn't allow George to see much of the world or other fish, and probably what happens then is that George gets repelled from that animal. So already from that idea you get probably these three modes of moving in groups. But also the idea that, unlike in the case of Galton and Condorcet, there is a different, in principle, there could be different weights into different animals because of many reasons, could be morphological, kinematical, or whatever. So this is what the intuition of the models is. But then let's see whether we see something like that or not.
But Gonzalo, are you not backing onto Cousins' model? That's more or less like Jan Cousins' model was essentially like based on those elements, you know, combining them. So how did you move on? I mean, like you had your Bayesian model, now you want to fuse the two? Is that?
Well, I don't want to do it. Let's see what happens. This is, I agree. So both in normal models of collective behavior, you would have these three modes. They are put by hand, by heuristics. What I'm saying is that these models are consistent with this idea. Now, but also with the idea that you should be weighting animals differently. You should not do a mean, okay? Now, I'm going to look at the data and see what happens. Maybe neither of these appear, or this doesn't appear. I don't know. Okay? That's all I'm saying.
What's the question that I had before?
Yes,
is a cost value, meaning imagine that the animal has some fin that is broken or that there is some particular turbulence and it's costly to actually, given the model attractiveness, there is some cost associated to even go there. So where in this...
It's not here.
Okay.
You will need to go to utility theory, which we... a way of combining these probabilities with cost values, but it's not here.
Okay,
so that's the intuition, but then we need the data. So one of the things we had to do a few years ago is to think of how we could obtain high quality data to start to think about group behavior. We were unhappy, as you saw, with those experiments before, and we needed to do something like this. So imagine you have two animals. This is the basic problem of tracking animals in groups. Imagine you have George and Tom. They might interact in a given region of space, and then they come out of that region. You can try to make an effort of following the animals in the interaction, but you might be wrong. And if you are wrong in the assignment, you will be wrong for the rest of the video. So very quickly, even if your model for tracking is quite good, the assignment of animals to images will be random. So what we wanted to do was to actually identify the animals. So in 2014, we published a paper which was basically a texture type of analysis of the image of animals, and if you do look at a given representation, I will not go into details, of that image for George and for Tom, and you see the two animals coming out, you will say that this one has to be George and this one has to be tone. And if you do it, then you get it right most of the time. And when you get it wrong, which is very rare, it does not propagate. It will be, you will be checking always the images. And if you, even if you are wrong for a few frames, you will be corrected by the system.
So if you look at, sorry, what is the feature of the fish, or what are the images?
This thing here?
Yeah.
If you want to go into the details?
No, just an idea.
The idea, so we wanted it to be rotational and translational invariant. So we were looking at all the pairs of pixels, just the distance between two pixels and the intensities. And you calculate that the histogram, you compute the histogram of intensity of pixel 1, intensity of pixel 2, and the distance. That would be a three-dimensional histogram. Instead of doing that, I do the histogram of the sum of the two intensities and the distance. And that's translational and rotational invariant, and I give you that histogram.
But that's translational. What about?
Oh, okay. See, so the fish, you're right. So it's translational and rotational invariant for an image, not for the fish doing weird things. But you have, so what happens is that typically you have a reference set obtained from the video with different postures, and that's okay. So you have a set of images from the video that give you typically enough variability of the postures. But that's not how we do it now, and the reason is that when we did this system, for zebrafish we could do up to 15 fish, but we wanted to see what happens in larger groups. For that, what we do today is we use convolutional networks, and we go very quickly. We can explain it to you in the lab, in the QBio lab. You can come this evening if you want, and we can show to you how it works. The basic idea is that you have two convolutional networks. One is dedicated to distinguish whether a blob of something that could be an animal is really two animals interacting or crossing, or is an individual. And the other convolutional network is dedicated to, once you have isolated the individuals, to know whether it is number 57 or 61, one of the 100 in the dish. So if we plot, let's say that we have a video of 100 individuals, and these are the frames in the video. Each of these black dots is when this network has determined that there is a crossing, two animals are crossing. And it's white when it has determined that it's an individual. So you can see that in a typical video of a zebrafish, you have hundreds of crossings. Now, we need a training data set for both of them. Let me explain the second one. So what you do is you go into the video and find the chunks of video in which animals are not crossing. You just need one frame in which the animals are not crossing, and you extend each of the animals to its crossing. Okay? This is, you choose first the largest one. It turns out to be this one here. So we use this as our training data set. Animals are not crossing, so I will say that George is number one, Tom is number two, and then you have 100 of those. And I use that as training data set. I train my network, and then I apply the network to the rest of the video. And there are typically hundreds of these little chunks, but we have a quality test of all those chunks, and we determine which ones might be the ones best assigned, and we keep those inside the training data set, and we eliminate all the rest. Now we train the network with this training data set, and again, we apply it to the rest of the video, run a quality check of which chunks are best assigned, and we keep some of them, and we keep doing it until it covers most of the video. So the procedure is fully automatic, it's a species agnostic. I didn't explain the details, but I can promise to you we don't use any zebrafish features to do this. And accuracy might depend on many things, but for this video, for example, is 99.997%. Okay, so it's very good, and you don't need humans to check it.
Now, how many pixels do you have per animal?
So the number of pixels in this particular case is typically 100. We have done checks of what is the minimum number of pixels you could do. it depends on the group size, but for a group size of 50, 100, the minimum would be around 50. But typically we have in the safer regime 100, 150.
It's only 10 by 10 pixels per animal,
do you think? This is pixels per animal, see.
So it's 10 by 10 square per animal?
If, yes, but on the animal, 100. Okay. Paco wants.
Images are typically like 56 by 56, and the area where the animal is around 100 to 200 pixels. It might vary wherever they are in the room.
But that's in high quality images. If you have blur or you have other light problems, then you might need more.
So the what's missing to get 100% are the crossings where you cannot resolve?
I don't know, sorry. It's true that I didn't resolve the crossing. We have another algorithm to resolve the crossings. It's a different one. It's not that difficult because you know who is who entering the crossing and out of the crossing, so we have an interpolation algorithm that manages to do it quite well. No, it can be. Typically what happens is that there are some crosses in which the two animals cross, then there are a couple of frames and they cross again. So we use a Bayesian framework. Once there is an assignation of each of the frames, we accumulate all the assignations between two crossings to make an estimation. But when you have only two, three in between, the estimation is worse. It can happen that sometimes it gets it wrong.
Can you use it over time? Can you actually look at the same fish over time and recognize who is George over time?
You mean within the video or in another video?
Like you could look at the same fish, but have a developmental study where you look at how fish become social or you know how they change their preference over time.
By using different videos, you mean, or
yeah,
having always one camera
videos.
On the same?
I mean, you could use the same setup, but you would have the fish coming back to the experiments weeks after weeks, you know. Could you use the pattern recognition to recognize the same animal over time?
So it's, I mean, yes, in the adult case, in the development case, the animals are changing
right.
All the time, so you need to take care of that change. It can be done, but you need to take care of that. Okay, so this is how it looks for zebrafish. If you want to find a mistake, you need to focus on one. But I think in this chunk, this video, there are no mistakes.
Which one?
And also you get a sense of how an experiment with 100 zebrafish looks like.
Do they never collide?
Never collide?
Yeah.
Well, I can get very close, but what would be a collision?
Well, essentially they change their trajectory because they sense the other one, as opposed to just crossing
each other. Well, they do repel each other, so it might not look dramatic, but they can do that, yes. We will see that.
How deep is the container?
This is 3.5. Well, the container is much deeper, but the amount of water is 3.5. It's plenty of, I mean, these are juveniles, 30 days. They are little beasts. So they have plenty of room to cross. And as you saw in the graph, there were hundreds of crossings. So we're not trying to avoid them.
If you just track them ahead, is that sufficient to apply the algorithm and do identity without worrying about the body?
So that's a possibility, yes. So
that makes problems simpler because you actually...
Yeah, exactly. So that's one possibility to track the head, but the algorithms to find a head will be species-specific. So there is no one algorithm to find the head of any animal. So we want it here to be species-agnostic. So a tracking system that works for any species. Now, if you know how to, in your species, track...
You just need
an algorithm to find a head, you're fine. Yes. And that's for Drosophila, it's a bit more difficult for the system. It can achieve around 80, but it suffers. So 50 might be okay. But as you saw, it's so beautiful in zebrafish, but why would you want to do it?
Are these larvae, though? These are adults.
These are adults.
Yeah, adults. Yeah. Walking adults.
Yeah, half of them are not they're waiting for someone to bump into them. But they are alive.
So for the zebrafish case, the worst case scenario is if you have dappled light on there or if there is some water surface interaction, that would be the worst thing for your tracking.
Yeah, so there are many ways of making life difficult for the tracking. We record in infrared so you can have light to be in the visible within whatever you want. So we record in infrared. We had many times ripples produced by the fish. That seems to be okay. We actually use it in your system. It seems to work fine for the flow case as well. Okay, so I was driving you to consider now this data and a data-driven way of modeling collective behavior and see what happens. The idea is from those videos to learn a model. The way I'm going to do it is to consider a focal animal, again, George, and we are going to build a model that will predict the future of George in 1 second. So George in the future is going to be here, and I want a model that gets as close to that as possible. So the input to the model is going to be the kinematic values of George and of some of the friends around George. And then it will try to predict the future. I'm going to give you the result and then how we build the model. This is every 1 second, we center always in George. So this is George. This is the future of George, the real future, and this is the predicted future of George. So if these 2 points are very different, the model is bad. If they are close, the model is good.
Can you play it again?
Yes. Oops. Let me know.
So you don't identify the direction, the orientation of the fish, it's just the velocity that you use to do.
So the center coordinate is centered on George, and the y-axis is the velocity.
But for each fish, it looks like ellipsoid, so it looks like it has orientation. But in the videos, you don't identify the...
No, I'm going to use for the model only the position of the center of mass and the velocity vector. I'm not going to use posture.
If the fish is not moving, you cannot really approximate the ellipse.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And then model predictions are taking the dark blue guys.
So this point is a prediction.
Yeah, but I mean the distinction between light is the
fish that go into the model are the ones in darker blue, and these ones I don't take them into account because I keep changing the numbers, and those seem to be already fine. Okay, so what is the model? The model is the following one. It's a network that takes the present and predicts the future of George. And the way it does this is the following. We're going to use a coordinate system centered in George, and the y-axis is in the velocity vector of George. And then this is Tom. Tom is at xy position in the center of George. And one can consider many variables. The ones that work best for us, we could include more, but the accuracy didn't go up. We included the speed of George, the acceleration in the perpendicular of George, the position of Tom, and the velocity of Tom, and the angle of Tom respect to to this axis. So these are six variables. Okay, you can include more, but the accuracy didn't go up. So you introduce these six variables, two are of the focal animal and four of the neighbor, into a network like this one. And the trick, if you have played with networks, is to find, although we say that they are universal approximators, what the trick typically is to find a hypothesis that might correspond with the data in a way that then it can be trained. The hypothesis I use here is that the interactions are in pairs. So this is the interaction of George and Tom. This is George and Lucy, George and another one, and you have around 20 of them. And I'm going to assume that that those interactions are going to be identical. So I don't assume that there are different types of animals. I add the outputs that are 128 values for each of the networks. You have 128 values. It goes to another network, and then the output is going to be whether George is going to turn right or left 1 second in the future. Okay? So these are the variables I'm going to consider. This is the interaction between a pair of animals, and this is the interactions of all the pairs and the aggregation of those pair interactions to give me as output whether George is going to move to the right or to the left 1 second in the future. You train it in the data and you test it in non-trained data. Now, the problem of this is that, as you saw in the video before, at least to my taste, seems to work quite well. But these networks are not very insightful. Unlike the models I was explaining before, the dimensionality in the end is very high, 128 values here. And it's very difficult to have any insight of what is going on. So instead of using this network for insight, I'm going to use a different one. The variables that go into the network are going to be the same in the interaction in pairs. Instead of having 128 output values, I'm going to have a single one. And basically, what I'm going to say is that the future of George, going to the right or to the left, is given by the interaction in pairs, but weighted with another function. Okay. So basically, instead of having a all-to-all connectivity in an aggregation network here, what I'm going to have is that this output gets multiplied by the output of another network. And then it's summed here to give me the prediction. These networks, I didn't invent them. They're called attention networks, and they're being quite successful for many problems. Now, for this little network here, the attention network, we also checked many variables, and the ones that work were those ones. You can think of them if you wanted the same six ones, but we eliminated two of them for simplicity and because it didn't give higher accuracy. Okay, so the idea is that interactions are in pairs, and I'm weighting the output of those interactions by this function here, and I'm going to normalize it. So I need to impose that this is a positive value. I do it with an exponential, and I also need to normalize. And the other tricks I can tell you later. But the idea is simple. The idea is that instead of using all-to-all aggregation network, I'm going to assume that these little networks might do the job. And actually, it turns out that the accuracy you get with this network and the previous one is basically the same. So it really seems to capture the data well. But the nice thing is that in the end, although the two networks have many parameters, each of them is a function of not so high number of variables. So this one is a function of six variables, and it's a function of four variables. So we can try to plot these things. The parameters are not going to be insightful, but the function, we can look at it. So let's...
Why not just combine all of them, like in one? Like if you have 100 animals.
Combine them like...
Like four animals in one.
Yes, so we tried that, and it's very difficult to train like that. By in which type of network? In one of these? No, you need an all-to-all network. So you have, if the input is the all the values, and you read through an all-to-all network with several layers, it's extremely difficult to make it train. It trains a bit, and it gives you a really low accuracy. So the trick was trying to find something that is simpler, that might still be in the data, so it can be trained. And these ones worked. OK, so we can now look at the function. This is a six-dimensional function, and this is a four-dimensional function. Now, we cannot plot functions in six dimensions, but because the different variables are quite different physically, still it makes sense to do it. So these are the variables as before. What I'm going to do is to put Tom at seven body lengths to the right of George and one body length in front. Okay? I'm going to consider that George is moving with an acceleration in the perpendicular equal to zero, so he's not turning, and he's moving at the what is the mean velocity in this video, 3.5 body lengths per second, the focal. And what they plot here is the angle of Tom and the speed of Tom. So what happens here is that when Tom is moving fast, when the angle is something like this, then George tends to the right, so it gets aligned to Tom. And it's when Tom moves to the left, George also moves to the left. So this is probability of moving to the right being high. This is being low, so it moves to the other side. So basically, when Tom is moving fast, George just is aligning to him. But that's different when Tom is moving slow. In that case, it doesn't get aligned. It gets attracted independently of the angle of Tom. George gets attracted to Tom. So velocity is important. I got that question before. If now we have Tom in a different position in space, let's say closer now, one body length to the right of George, and three body lengths in front, but again, George is not turning and is moving at the mean velocity. When Tom is moving fast, George aligns to Tom. But when Tom is moving slow, gets repelled. So it's to the right here, Tom. And independently of the angle, when Tom is moving slow, George moves to the left. So you get very different behaviors at low velocities. Okay? So we do see alignment, we do see attraction, with this we do see repulsion. But you plot
It would be very helpful if you could put this in context of these other models of flocking that there seems to be quite a few models around.
Yes.
So are these very different interactions, similar interactions? Could you comment on that?
Let me just give you more a full account of what comes out, and we can discuss how far it is. Now, let's put George in the center of the coordinate system, and we have one of these plots for wherever Tom could be. Now, the richness of this graph is much higher than any of the models that you were mentioning before, but let's try to make contact with them. Okay? So, to make contact with them, I'm going to simplify these plots. I'm just going to look at when George gets aligned to Tom and when it gets repelled. Okay? So, if we look at this graph here, this is position in space. George is in the center of the coordinate system, and these are the regions in which it gets repelled by Tom. These are the ones that gets attracted to Tom, and these are the ones that gets aligned to Tom. Okay. So what happens is that this velocity of Tom is much lower than the mean velocity. These two are below the mean velocity, and these are higher. So what you see when you go higher in the velocity of Tom, you lose the attraction and repulsion zones, and everything goes into orientation. So there is a very strong dependency on the velocity of tone on what regions you find, which, for example, is not in the model I was showing to you before. That was a constant velocity model, the Cassin model. Here, the dependency with the velocity of tone is super high. The existence of the zones that are already a simplification of what you find in the six-dimensional space are very dependent on the velocity of the neighbor. That you don't find, for example, in the Cassin model, all the animals are moving at constant velocity. And only those zones will exist at very low velocities of tone.
So all of these pictures are left-right symmetric, right? And that there's probably a good reason.
Actually, it's forced.
Sorry?
It's forced.
It's forced, okay.
It's forced in the network.
It's forced in the network, okay.
I mean, you do data analysis, you will also find it. But the way the network is trained is forced.
So also, do you see any evidence that you cannot predict the position unless you look for higher order or whatever motion, higher order interactions between the animals beyond the second
order? So Ilya is worried that I only use pair interactions. You should also consider whether high-order interactions matter or not. The accuracy was super high already with pair interactions, but to answer your question, what we need to explicitly add pieces of the network to do that job, and we didn't do it. So I cannot explicitly, I can only say that this works very well. There's a bit room for improvement. I don't think it's high-order interactions. I think it's stochasticity from animals doing stuff. I don't think it's, my intuition is that it's not high order interactions, but I don't have a proof.
When you look, sorry, probably the last question, this type of plots that you just showed, the maps of attraction, repulsion, and so on and so forth, can you somehow rationalize them in terms of, I don't know, some kind of Bayesian?
So I try to prime you on that. I told you before that my expectation, given the Bayesian framework, is that animals too close to George will not make George to see the world very well. So you should get repelled and try to find a better place. If they are fairly far away, you can get attracted to them. Now, do I have an intuition of why it depends so much on velocity? I do. I'm not sure I can transmit it to you very well. But probably can be explained basically by correlation, because if everyone is going very fast already, there is no room for repulsion or attraction to make much. They're all going together at fast velocity. That's maybe not helping you, but we can discuss later. Let me finish, because actually what is interesting for me is the other part of the network, the weighting part. It's a function, again, of the variables. If we plot similar plots than the ones before, but for the weight that each pair has, for a given pair, you will find, again, that depends a lot on velocity. The weight is much higher for animals that are very close and in front of George, but also has a very strong increase with velocity. So animals going faster are going to have a higher weight in general. Here is the same plot, but now moving up the velocity of the focal. So making the focal going faster makes the weights of animals in front of George to be more important. Now, although velocity turns out to be very important, it's not going to be easy to find that in experiments if you are not careful, because the importance of something in an experiment is going to be relative to all the rest of the animals. So you can have one animal going very fast, but if another animal is very close to George, it doesn't matter whether it's going slow. It might be the most important one, and you will see an animal going fast and has no importance. And the reason for that is that the final impact of another animal depends on the values of the weights of the other animals as well. So to put that more explicitly, instead of looking at the numerator, let's look at what would be the value in typical frames for the whole weight. This is an example frame in which all the weights are shared by the animals around. This could be similar to the Condorcet-Galton case. Most animals count the same. This one, you have higher weights in some of the animals, could be an oligarchy type of frame. But other frames in which one animal has the highest weight, like this one. So if you score by some inequality index, what happens through the video, you will have a distribution like this. It's very unlikely that they are very democratic. Most of the cases will be something like this, but there is a long tail of many cases in which a single animal will have the highest weight. So as Jimmy was saying, it will be here, yeah, they have an opportunity for one animal, for example, having been in front and a high velocity, had the opportunity of having the highest weights for George, and not to aggregate the information of all the animals around. So depending on the weights of all the animals, George will do one thing or the other, from being very democratic, one of them controlling what George is going to do in the future. And this is the summary. So in the summary, I wanted to express the following. One is that it is possible to build models of attraction or even collective behavior. We've done, I didn't explain. The nice thing about those models is that all the parameters are under control. So you know what they are because you derived the mathematics. So those parameters, you exactly know what they are. But it's very difficult, given the complexity of a collective, to predict that how the animals are going to be weighted by their different kinematics, or how the dependency with velocity is going to be, given the theory. The theory is too free for you to say that. So to be able to say something like that, we build tracking systems of large groups of animals. We apply it to zebrafish, and we started now to look at possible ways of modeling in a very predictive way the motion of animals in groups that can be both predictive and ideally also insightful. We managed to be partially insightful, at least in this particular case, by having these attention networks that are have many parameters, but the functions are of low dimensionality, so you can plot things and see what's new in them. So one thing that is new is that although the terms alignment, attraction, and repulsion are not strict, you can try to connect with previous theories that use them. But even if you do so, these are useful only at low velocities and not at high velocities. For me, more interestingly, you find that animals can shift all the time between something like an average or a majority vote to a minority vote. And that's going to be very important, I think, for us. We are testing how that impacts the decisions of animals in groups. And we are teaching some of the animals some things and seeing whether these type of rules allow the group to follow them more than what would happen if they were using something like an average. And with that, I finish. And let me just, sorry, acknowledge the people that really did the work, if the slide goes. So Paco, you know, he's here, and you can find him and me. I helped Paco in the QBio lab. He developed with Mattia Bergomi the tracking system, and he's a master of setups and experiments as well. Robert is also helping in experiments and setups, and Francisco Eras is the guy behind the deep learning model. Thank you very much.
Just to clarify, this 85% number depends on some discrepancy in time.
Yes, but not very strongly. So if you look at from 0.5 seconds to 3-4, that number stays. It really starts to. What's that?
And you have a time beam. Time beam.
Well, it's, the time beam is 1 over 30.
5%, that's the likelihood to predict accurately the turn.
Yes.
So the turn is discrete.
I just look at whether it's more to the right or to the left of the velocity vector in the present in 1 second.
1 second?
1 second. I can do it in 0.5 in.
What is the average distance between?
Oh, but the animals are all the time turning. So actually, the kinematics already of movement will make the animal be all the time turning at very low, small angles. And those ones I don't predict very well. It's when they turn that I predict well. How often? Typically in the quarter second.
If it was a random predictor, what would be the number?
A random predictor, so I have the figure, is 55. And if you use like a better model, let's say that you use the acceleration, you start to use the focal dynamics, it can go to 60.
Imagine the carry, so the dynamic is always dynamic, meaning that instead of George identify Tom, it would identify probably according to the distance, the neighbors. So I don't know when you train your data sets for a specific pairing between the two, in principle, their interaction would be a function of distance.
Yeah, so the way it works.
Take into account of that.
Yeah, so yeah. The way it works, I take the N neighbors closer to George.
So and the N. Neighbor, yeah. But these have different. They're constant. It's a dynamic shift. So who's going to be the neighbor?
Any neighbor. I take into account any neighbor in the. Any of the. Independently of the space, I take the N neighbors. Okay? That's what the model does.
N neighbors, and this is, and you follow through the whole.
You train in the whole video.
Train the whole. Okay.
And then you test in another part of the video.
Yes, yes. Another N and train the whole. So that effectively takes into account.
All the pairs are forced to be the same model, okay? Because you are summing.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe a general question. I wonder how much. When you have a model that is very good at predicting, how much it really tells us about the strategy the animal is using. I'm often surprised how the inputs in this kind of model are different they are from the sensory system. Maybe you give a lot of information the fish doesn't have at all. Maybe it doesn't discretize the world into the different frames. Or like velocity could be, does the fish monitor its own velocity or is it a consequence of optic flow or whether the fish move or not the fish move? And how much would it be possible to try to input into your model, like, I don't know, a visual input that a given fish would receive or something like that?
Yeah, so that's something that we are planning to do next, yes. So it's not that difficult, and that's the plan, not to include. Now there are, like, physics variables. We are going to, actually, we do have already some work in which we have, a more natural input to the retina and a more natural action space. So I didn't show that. So this was something in between the simple models at the beginning and still keeping something simple in these models. One of the simplicity parts is that the variables are still like in physics. But you're right, one should consider what the retina has.
Yeah. It may become simpler. Sometimes
I'm
simplest.
Yeah, so in my intuition is not going to be easy to understand it. Yes, Eugenio.
Let's maybe move to the coffee.